If we look at safeguarding as an outworking of our gospel witness and our biblical principles, it's actually not hard to do if we're being church to each other.
And actually not just not hard to do, something that's joyful to do. Hello and welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name is Adrian Reynolds. I'm head of national ministries and I'm joined today by two guests who are married. But if you're watching on video, we've sat them apart. There's nothing behind that. They just, one happens to be sitting on my left, one happens to be sitting on my right. I think everything's okay in the Harrison household, but just in case. So, Paul, lovely to have you with us.
And
Sue, thanks so much for joining us. Just tell us briefly who you are. Sue, you go first.
I'll go first. Okay, I'm Sue Harrison, a wife of Paul.
Marriage, okay. Yep.
Very well, thank you. Yes, kids all left home, great. I am... wife of Paul. He's an elder at one of the FIEC churches in Loughborough. I work for Christian Safeguarding Services, CSS.
Yep.
In my voluntary capacity, I'm a trustee, but I also do a lot of work behind the scenes and up front with the training.
Great, thank you very much, Paul. And tell us about you, Paul.
Yeah, hi.
So this is your wife.
This is Sue, my wife. So I'm Sue's husband. As Sue says, leader within an FIEC church, and I am full time in Christian Safeguarding Services.
Okay, and we're here to talk about safeguarding. Mm. And our safeguarding is one of those words that to many church leaders just makes them come out in hives, but because you know, in all the sort of the admin of doing church, one of the most onerous things it feels, I guess, over the last 15 years, that sort of time frame, that's really sort of loomed large in church life, safeguarding policies. And we kind of know they're important. Kind of, I think we're reluctant adopters in some cases. And actually, we're here to say today to talk about safeguarding in a more positive way, aren't we? Because we want to see that as a key part of church life and help leaders especially think how they can be more positive and how they can lead their churches more positively when it comes to safeguarding. So we're trying to move away from safeguarding, got to renew the policy, got to find a safeguarding policy, to actually, yes, safeguarding, that's part of our... I mean, you have this great phrase, safeguarding to the glory of God. We want to see it in that sort of way, don't we, Sue?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're as
old... Why?
Well, if you're as old as me, you will remember the 1989 Children Act.
Are you feeding me a line there?
You will remember the 1989 Children Act when churches had to go through the process of adopting child protection policies. Okay. And it was daunting.
So when I said it was 15 years ago, it was actually...
15 years ago? No, it was a long time ago.
But it's much longer than that, isn't it?
1989.
Okay.
The 1989 Children Act is where the first piece of legislation around safeguarding children came into being, adults slightly later. But we were in churches, you know, we were running Sunday schools, we were doing mums and toddlers, and we had to have a child protection policy. And this
probably
was
the first
alien
policy that churches had ever had.
Absolutely.
Actually.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it was very alien, very daunting, very processy, tick box exercise. Yeah. We've got to do this, guys. Now it's evolved. Things have changed. Legislation's changed. And actually, if we put it in the right, I call it the right bucket, if we look at safeguarding as an outworking of our gospel witness and our biblical principles, it's actually not hard to do if we're being church to each other.
And actually not just not hard to do, something that's joyful to do.
Absolutely.
Because actually looking after others, serving one another, that's a joyful thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it should be it joyful.
So how do we get it in the right bucket? I'm positive about safeguarding personally. I think, you know, church meeting is quite a hard sell.
Yes, it is.
We've got to have a safeguarding policy. Everyone puts their hands up to say, of course we do.
Yeah.
But actually to say to a church, and this is actually really important, this is part of our Christian love and witness. I think that's quite a hard thing to get across.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit more about how we get it in the right bucket.
Of course. And I think one of the things that for me is really important is to, in a sense, separate things out here. The policy is an important part of what we do, but that's not safeguarding. That's just the framework in which we do safeguarding.
That's helpful. Right.
Okay.
So immediately I'm corrected there because I'm thinking that is safeguarding. But so just unpack that a little bit for me.
Yeah, of course.
Well,
if we really boil this down, safeguarding comes down to two things. It's how do we care well for people, particularly those who are not able to protect themselves? How do we protect them from harm? And how do we create an environment that is nurturing, that is caring, where people can grow, they can thrive? If I was speaking to a secular group, I would say where they have the opportunity to fulfill their potential. Within the church, of course, what we're saying really is where they can really see that process of the Holy Spirit working in their lives, see that sanctification, that increasing holiness. How do we create an environment that allows people to thrive, to become all that the Lord created them to be? And so for us, it's very much about saying, look, if we go back, and that's not my definition, that's what the state tells us, safeguarding is those two things, protecting people from harm, promoting their well-being. If we then say, okay, so what does Scripture have to say about that? All of a sudden, we see a whole range of things coming out that we don't automatically assume associate with safeguarding.
Yeah. So fundamentally, loving your neighbour as yourself.
Correct.
Is one of the greatest commands.
Absolutely.
And actually, if we want to be obedient as Christians to the call of Jesus in our lives, then we've got to be doing just that. We've got to be loving God with all our heart, soul, mind and strength.
Absolutely.
Loving our neighbour as ourself. Who is your neighbour?
Yep.
If we were to rewrite the parable of the Good Samaritan in church terms, who's our neighbour? It's the person that comes along to Mother and Tots.
Yep.
It's the person who comes to the youth group. It's a very natural outworking of biblical principles.
It is. Yeah. And this is one of the things that we try to help churches to understand, particularly in the training. It is, once we understand what safeguarding is, we start to relate to it on a spiritual level, a biblical level, rather than on a sort of regulatory level.
Do you think...
Now, of course, it is important just to say, you know, that we do reach a threshold, a legal threshold, where we legally have to refer things through to the appropriate agencies. And I know that sometimes there's some reluctance with churches in some contexts to do that. There can be concern, there can be fear. The way that I often express this when we're training is the reason why sometimes we have to pass this on beyond the church is there are things that the church is not able to do, they're not legally able to do, that other agencies can. And so, for example, if we have a child who is being really seriously harmed, let's say, for example, at home, much as our heart goes out to that child and we want to just take them home with us, we can't do that. Yeah. That is called kidnap, and we will be arrested for it. You know, so there are actually some things that we cannot do to protect children. And so what the state is saying is, look, where we reach that threshold, we need to involve the appropriate agency. So there is that dimension to safeguarding, but most of what we deal with is actually how do we love each other well.
Yeah. And just a thought on that statutory threshold, I've only once had to contact authorities, found the authorities really, really helpful, really understanding. I wasn't quite sure whether it was or it wasn't.
Yeah.
And we decided we would err on the side of caution, contact authorities. They were very helpful, very clear. And I think that's probably a lot of people's experience, isn't it? It's not something to be frightened of.
Almost universally. I wouldn't want to say that things never go wrong. You know, sometimes things do go wrong in the statutory sector, just as they do in other places. Yeah, but the point is, within the statutory sector, there is always a process to challenge that.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think for churches, we don't realise how much of an impact we can make. Mm-hmm. For families. Mm. We look at the statutory end of the safeguarding, and the local authorities are involved. We know of churches where churches have been involved with families and social care have closed the case.
Mm. Right.
Because the support is so fantastic from the church.
Yeah, that's great testimony, isn't it?
And I mean, you know, we've got a church that we have contact with not too far from here, where they have actually been told explicitly by social care, if you weren't working with that family, they would be on the child protection register. But because you are, we're able to de-escalate that. And I think that's a phenomenal witness for the church to be able to say we're making that much difference in people's lives.
Yeah. So it sounds to me, in terms of my experience, my historical experience of doing safeguarding policies and being involved in safeguarding policies, I've put them in the wrong box or the wrong bucket. And I guess that's because there was this initial, you know, the Children Act, got to have a safeguarding policy, got to have a safeguarding policy. So it always was in the legislative bucket, you know, the policy I've got to have. rather than actually this is just a reflection of an attitude that believers should have anyway. Is that a, is that a fair assessment?
That's very fair. One of the things that we say a lot in training, and please don't take this to mean we don't need this, the regulatory stuff. Yeah, we do. Yeah. The policy is really important. But actually, safeguarding should be more about who we are than what we do.
Just
it's about the values.
I'm a bear of little brain. Just say that again.
Safeguarding is more about who we are than what we do.
Right, okay.
In other words, if we be church, if we be biblical, if we live out what we believe, we will automatically safeguard people.
Right. And a policy isn't going to make you care for people.
Correct. Right. Correct.
It's going to protect you when things go wrong, perhaps, or whatever, but it's...
That's right. And also it gives you a framework so that you're not making things up as you go along.
For example?
Well, let's say, for example, we have an allegation against a youth worker. A young person makes an allegation. That might be a valid allegation. In other words, the youth worker may have done something wrong. It may be a misunderstanding, a genuine misunderstanding. It may be a malicious allegation. And there's obviously various stages in between as well. But what the safeguarding policy does is it gives us a framework in which to deal with that with justice. It upholds the right of the vulnerable person. It gives them the protection that they need. But it also gives our workers the protection that they need by setting proper boundaries for them and having a proper process, a transparent process through which these things can be addressed. One of the things that I think has become increasingly important in the sense it's recognised that it's of increasing importance now is not just doing the right thing, but being seen to do the right thing.
Yes.
And of course, when I say that, I don't mean that we give the impression that we are doing the right thing when we're not. What I mean is we are doing the right thing, but we're not doing it behind closed doors. There's accountability, there's transparency there.
Now, I've got our church's safeguarding policy in front of me here. It's fairly dry, 10 pages. I guess a lot of churches will have similar things or perhaps even longer. So practical advice for Sue on how either to make it less dry or to connect it with people's real lives and ministry. What could we do with ours? I'm not asking you to read it.
It's just
a statement of things. Yeah. how do we make it more? I'm not asking for words, but how do we in terms of policy make this more of something that will be in people's kind of heads and hearts, I suppose.
Okay, I think you have your intentional statement there. What church is about, that what your commitments are.
Yep.
I think you have your procedures fairly high up.
Okay.
So people know what to do. People aren't going to read a policy. The people that need to know the policy are the trustees.
Yeah, okay.
The church members need to know it exists. They need to know who they need to talk to if there's a concern. And it's about having the most accessible information at the top of your policy.
Right. Okay.
And so our templates will have those that framework for churches. But again, it's only a template. Churches can tweak it however they want.
Sure.
But basically, take the young person who maybe there's an allegation about a youth leader. That gets reported to a person in church. That person in church needs to be able to go to the paperwork, know who to talk to.
I know where it is.
Absolutely.
I know
what to do. And actually, I need to talk to X. But actually, if X isn't around, this is what I need to do. Mm-hmm. So it's about having it sort of almost a living document. As soon as they go to the document, they need to know what they need to do.
Okay. And I think, things we've found as we've reviewed ours over the years is... addresses and phone numbers go out of date very quickly.
Yes.
You know, here's a helpline number that you can call. And we got someone actually to call all our numbers on our policy to see whether they actually worked, and discovered that some of these charities and sort of helpline numbers didn't exist anymore.
That's a really good idea. That's a really good idea.
It was slightly embarrassing to say, I'm just calling to see if this number works when people were there. But actually, it's important, isn't it? Because if you've got a list of contact numbers and they're just irrelevant, then the policy is...
And that's
really
why it's important to update it every 12 months.
Okay. Is that a statutory requirement to update it every 12 months? It's not a statutory requirement,
but it is good practice.
Okay. What is statutory?
There isn't. It must be reviewed regularly.
Right. Okay.
But, I mean, if we take the guidance, for example, for schools, that is annually renewed. Right. Every single year, there's a new version comes out. And of course, review doesn't mean that you're updating it. Review just means you've looked at it and you've said, yes, it's still fit for purpose. Yeah. So we would say review it annually. And obviously, if you're signed up to one of the safeguarding services, they will be refreshing their policies regularly. Yeah, so you can just see what changes are coming through. Yeah. But I think, again, in terms of churches, remember the purpose of your safeguarding policy. Very often we look at policies and you get the impression that they're written more in case somebody asks to see it than they are to help people to do what they
sure
need
that's,
to do.
Let's be honest, I'm sure that's the way church leaders think about them.
Yeah.
I've got to have this in case someone asks if I've got it.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's what we're trying to move away from, isn't it? This kind of attitude we're trying to...
It is. And of course, the policy is only one part. That's the framework. Yeah, that gives us the framework. But the policy should never be a replacement for training. We need to be training our teams at a proportionate level. But we need to be training. You know, what do the trustees need to know? What do the safeguarding leads need to know? What do our youth leaders need to know? What does everybody need to know? Because there are some very basic things that everybody needs to know. For example, home group leaders. You know, what do they need to know about safeguarding? And so really thinking about the format of the policy and the procedures. I think, again, one of the things that we see is real confusion between what's policy and what's procedure.
I don't know that. So tell me about that.
Yes. Yeah, so your policy is...
Let's pretend I don't know it. That's what I meant to say. Of course I know the difference, but let's pretend I don't know the difference. Goodness.
Yeah. So your policy is where you outline... You acknowledge your responsibilities and you make commitments as to how you're going to fulfill those in a broad overview sense.
Right.
The procedures then are the detailed step-by-step instructions that tell you how you're going to fulfill those commitments.
So your policy might be very closely linked to scriptural commands, for example, and actually wouldn't change that much. You know, your duty of care and your wanting to serve God by serving others, that's kind of unchangeable, isn't it?
Yeah.
But how you implement that might change. Yeah.
And it's one of the things that we would always encourage churches to do is just to have a statement about those biblical principles that have shaped our approach to safeguarding.
It's all right. I think our template policy, going from memory, our template policy is around six sides of A4. A4.
Okay.
It's the procedures that are the bulk.
Right. Just picking up on that, the difference between procedure and policy, suddenly my safeguarding training is a whole lot more interesting.
Yes.
Because actually I'm not just saying to people, here's the procedures.
Correct.
I'm saying actually, no, this is, you know, it's sermonic. Here's our scriptural call to care for people, and this is how we can do it. So the safeguarding policy, essentially, or the procedures, becomes the application of what our biblical commands are.
Yes.
Correct. And we get churches to say, can you come and train? Do you need to look at our policy before you come and deliver training?
Yeah, yeah.
The answer to that is no, we don't need to look at your policy because we train as to what your procedures should be.
Right.
So when we go in and train, we talk about case studies, we discuss scenarios, we have group discussion. And the main thrust of the training is you as volunteers need to know who you need to talk to, your designated safeguarding lead, and how you spot when things aren't right and who you need to talk to.
Okay.
So our training is very, very interactive, but we focus on procedure and being church.
Right. Okay.
And I think one of the things that's important to remember, I know it's kind of become standard practice, hasn't it? You know, you get a new youth worker comes onto the team and so you say, well, you've got to read and confirm that you understand the safeguarding policy. Now, I'm not suggesting we shouldn't do that. We absolutely should do that. But actually, if you think about it, there's a lot of stuff in your safeguarding policy that a youth worker doesn't need to know. They're not going to handle allegations. All they need to know is if someone makes an allegation, I pass this on to this person. Safe recruitment, they're not going to be involved potentially in safe recruitment. So there's a whole load of stuff that are listed in the safeguarding policy and procedures that ordinary members don't need to know about. Unfortunately, the demands are becoming ever greater. And so we're finding now that, you know, our policy all in all is getting close to 40 pages now. Now, the policy, as Sue says, is about 5 pages, and that includes a sort of header page and an index page and what have you. The procedure is about 14, 15 pages. But there's only probably 2 pages, a page and a half of that, that actually everybody needs to know about. The biggest section actually is the appendices, where we've got standard documents and those kinds of things that you can use. But asking people to sit and read that document, you know, they will go to sleep before they get to the end of it. Whereas if you stop and think about it, and this is what we encourage churches to do now, is if you have 2 documents, they will suffice for the vast majority of people. They're both single side of A4. The first one is a poster that says, these are the safeguarding leads. If you've got any concerns, these are the people you go to. And the second one is a flow chart that says, if you've got a concern, this is what you do.
Okay.
Get those into the policy, print them, laminate them, stick them on the wall on a notice board somewhere.
So I was at Charlotte Chapel at the weekend for an evangelism conference, and I was in the loo.
Yep.
You're there a whole day drinking lots of coffee. It's got to happen at some point. And I noticed that their safeguarding policies are on the wall in the loo. And in fact, in every loo.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's a great idea, isn't it?
Brilliant.
If you've got we haven't got a building, but if you've got a building, that's a great idea.
Absolutely. And some people put domestic abuse helplines in the
got
toilet
that as well. That's right.
Perfect.
Yeah. Got that as well. And I guess that's one of the things, isn't it? It's got to be accessible to people who need it.
Yes.
So one of the things that's just coming into my mind, just thinking about our church, we have people in church members who have sight loss.
Mm-hmm.
We've got people who need Braille copies, large print copies.
Yes.
So actually making something accessible. Mm. Well, you can't make a 40-page document probably.
No.
A 40-page document in Braille is, you know, about 4 inches thick.
Yeah.
But actually your one page summary can be accessible. Now, just let me just push that a little bit. What about children? Do children, or let's say those who are sort of sufficient intellectual capacity, you know, maybe they're a 12-year-old coming onto a youth group.
Yeah.
They need to be able to have that same access, don't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
We would say that we really ought to be talking to our children and young people, you know, particularly if the parents aren't around and we as churches are looking after children in our clubs. Children should know who they can go to with a concern.
Right.
If they're worried, they need to know who they can talk to.
Yeah. So policies that are written for lawyers... Or look as though they could only be, I'm not a lawyer, I can say this, I'm an accountant, I'm a simple soul. But actually, some of them do look as though they've been written by and for lawyers.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, if they've got that sort of level of impenetrability, then they're not going to serve the purpose, are they?
No, exactly. And I think that focus on purpose is really, really, really important. Right. And of course, an important part of this suite of documents that we kind of tend to say safeguarding policy, but we mean policy procedures. But another important part of that is codes of conduct.
Yeah.
So set the standards of behaviour that we expect. Now, we're using here all the terminology that government wants us to use.
Right.
You know,
right.
But actually, a code of conduct is just something that says, this is how we interact with each other. This is how we care for each other. This is the standard of behaviour that we should
Which
be
again,
expecting
for Christians
of each other.
Should be a natural thing, shouldn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
You know,
well, I mean, let me just play. I don't like the phrase because it's not a helpful phrase, but I'm going to say it. Devil's advocate. Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. I might say, well, actually, isn't our code of conduct Ephesians 4:5? But why have I got to set that out? On a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And there will be people who say, you know, we're Bible people. We've been talking today about how this sort of stuff all flows out of the Bible. Isn't it sufficient to say we're Bible people? Look, let's do what the Bible says.
We could say that, couldn't we? And we could say, well, we don't need preaching. Because give people a Bible, right?
You're speaking to a preacher now. How long have you got?
I'm speaking to a preacher as a preacher. So, yeah, absolutely. But we wouldn't use that argument in that context.
No, that's
we want
fair.
To understand what that is meaning. And when it comes to safeguarding, there are some things that we have to do in particular ways, for example. Scripture isn't going to help us with doing our DBS checks.
No.
We just have to do it the way it is. Now, I know there are some people who have real difficulty with that and questions over that. My own view is it's just a legal process. There's not a biblical principle at stake there. And I appreciate there are people who have matters of conscience on that and what have you. But as a church, we need to say, look, that's something helpful. It helps us to identify people who may pose a risk, and we want to protect everybody from those who may pose a risk. And so, you know, we're thinking in this kind of way. Yeah, you could say, you know, why do we need a code of conduct? But again, you know, we have systematic theology for a reason, don't we? I appreciate some people might not be big fans of systematic theology, but what it does is it brings together all of the different ideas around that particular theme into one place. And I think that's what the safeguarding policy is intended to do. Rather than us having to know and apply the whole of Scripture, we've done that thinking. In many ways, the safeguarding policy, in a sense, is a sermon. It's an exposition of what does this mean and what does this look like in our context.
So let me just, we're drawing towards an end, but I'd like to ask you about safeguarding officers. Mm. Mm. I think there will be church leaders who are thinking, I find it quite hard to get people to serve as safeguarding officers or a deputy safeguarding officer. Mm. Have you got any wisdom for us about how we can encourage people to take on that role, and also how we can help churches see it as a really key part of service in church life?
A designated safeguarding lead or safeguarding officer or safeguarding coordinator. There's lots of titles. It's difficult, isn't it? Because
I think people are more reluctant to serve generally in church life. Mm. That's my experience. Yeah. Especially out of COVID, people are sort of less reluctant, less willing to serve generally. And this feels like, of all the things I could do in church, this is not the thing I would say, let me.
No. It is a really important role. And who should be the designated safeguarding lead? They should be appointed by the trustees.
Right.
They should be a person who is competent in doing that particular role, because they're going to be party to information that the rest of the church are not going to be party to. It is a responsible role within the church. They should be supported. So as trustees, if a designated safeguarding lead has that role, they should be resourced, they should be supported, and they should receive training. Now, obviously, we do that training. I feel that for a designated safeguarding lead, they need to be as supported as much as they can be by a board of trustees, because actually they are acting on behalf of the trustees. Sure. Mm-hmm. It is a responsible role. I would suggest that you may have people in your church who are already quite close to safeguarding. They might be teachers. They might be in a health profession. They might be in another social care-y type profession. But you don't just have to have one. Share it. Have a safeguarding lead and a deputy, or a safeguarding lead and a safeguarding officer. Right. Share it out and use that as part of your ministry in your local church.
So we set ours apart as a deacon.
Yeah.
And not only appoint them as trustees, our elders are trustees, but we also vote for them as a church. Mm. Yes. So they feel and pray for them, they commit to pray for them as a church,
Absolutely.
Which seems to me to be a good,
Absolutely.
A good step.
The model that we've got, the model that we've got in our church is I am the safeguarding lead. I am also a deacon and I'm also a trustee.
Right. Okay. So you may have answered my next question.
Okay.
Which is a very practical question, especially in smaller churches, like the kind of church I'm serving in. Is it okay for the safeguarding lead to be related to a trustee? Mm. Sometimes people say to us, is that allowed? Is there a conflict of interest and all that sort of thing? Is that possible?
It is allowed. The main thing is to make sure that you have a route so that if there's a conflict, there's someone else that people can go to, which is often where the lead and the deputy comes in. If you want to report a concern and it's about the safeguarding lead themselves, or it's about their husband or their wife, who do we go to in that situation? Mm. And so that sort of having a deputy is really important. Sometimes the safeguarding lead isn't a trustee, so you might have a safeguarding trustee and then a safeguarding lead who does most of the day-to-day work. So again, there are different structures, but we do need that kind of sort of versatility in there. There needs to be more than one person that you can go to. But the other thing I think is really important to say, and we say this to our safeguarding leads when we do training, It is, and I think this helps from that point of view of how do we actually get somebody to do this role. What we often say to safeguarding leads is you don't need to know all of the answers to all of the questions, but you do need to recognise when there's a question to ask. And so long as you recognise there's a question to ask, we can find that answer for you.
So you don't need to be the expert.
Correct. I often describe safeguarding leads as being a little bit like a GP in a medical sense. So your GP isn't a specialist. They're not an expert in anything, but they know enough about everything to be able to get you to the
that
person.
That sounds to me like a receptionist in my GP, who seems to have most of the medical experts.
I think also round the role of the designated safeguarding lead, they should have a trustee that they can talk to.
Sure.
But not all the trustees necessarily need to know what the safeguarding issue is.
Okay, that's helpful as well. So we're wrapping up now. Yeah. This is really helpful because actually what we're touching on here is that safeguarding is not something that elders delegate to someone else. You know, it's in a sense, it's in our church at least, not like some of the other diaconal roles where actually we're saying, you know, it's not right for us to, you know, to wait on tables and neglect the ministry of word and prayer. So you go and wait on the tables. It's not that actually. It is core to the church's life.
Yes.
But it's the responsibility for it is delegated, if you like.
Yes.
Possibly. And that can work well. And I think just to bring it back to where we started, it's been really helpful for me to hear again just how safeguarding is. It's about us living out our Christian call, isn't it?
It is.
As churches and as Christians and as leaders, actually, it's about doing what Scripture commands. It's about loving our neighbour. And I think seeing it in that context is really helpful to me.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Paul. Thanks for Sue.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
I hope it's been a helpful listen or watch, if you've been listening or watching. This has been Independence. If you'd like to like us, we'd like you to like us. That would be helpful. Other people will be able to find us. And we look forward to being in touch with you soon.